Coming up is the news.
President says that Israel's shutdown of Palestinian NGOs will in no way stop them from exposing Israeli crimes. 30 hours and multiple deaths later, Somali forces bring down the curtain on the hotel siege drama in Mogadishu. And tragedy strikes in Turkey, where two road crashes leave dozens of people dead, including first responders and journalists. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafi. Good to have you with us. The top story this hour, Palestinian president slamming Israel's forced closure of seven Palestinian non-government organizations in the occupied West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas says that the regime's unilateral actions are unacceptable and in violation of international law. He held the international consensus condemning the closures, but he noted that practical international measures are needed to stop Israel's aggressive policies. Palestinian president added that the NGOs will continue to expose the Israeli crimes irrespective of the shutdown order. On Friday, nine European countries, including France and Germany, said that they were deeply concerned by the move. The United Nations also urged their regime to allow the NGOs to continue to work.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raid as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
Israeli forces have raided, sealed, and imposed closure orders on the offices of seven prominent Palestinian human rights and social services organizations in the West Bank. The Tel Aviv claims that those NGOs have links with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and that's a claim that they have rejected.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil rights, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designation as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by nine European states that fund targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. There are essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Okay, moving on with the rest of this news broadcast. The Somali military has ended the Al-Shabaab terrorist siege of a hotel in the capital, Mogadishu. The 30-hour crisis came to an end after forces pounded the Hyatt Hotel with heavy weapons late Saturday to eliminate the gunmen. Al-Shabaab launched a gun and bomb attack on the building on Friday. It killed at least 13 civilians and injured dozens more. Security sources say the building is yet to be cleared of possible explosives. This is the biggest attack in Mogadishu since Somalia's new government took office in June. Al-Shabaab is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda and controls much of southern and central Somalia. It's engaged in a long-running conflict with the federal government. Russia and the U.S. waging water wars over chemical weapons. Moscow has dismissed Washington's allegations that it possesses such arms. It says that the U.S. is in fact the only country not to have eliminated its arsenal. In a statement, the Russian embassy in Washington said that Moscow completely destroyed its stocks of chemical warfare agents in 2017. It says this has been officially confirmed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The mission called on the U.S. to stop evading its international obligations to eliminate chemical weapons. The statement was issued in response to claims made by Washington on the second anniversary of Russia's alleged chemical poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The Russian embassy also called on the U.S. not to interfere in Russia's domestic affairs. The daughter of a controversial Russian political commentator has been killed in a suspected car bomb attack outside Moscow. Investigators say that Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, was killed when a suspected explosive device detonated on the vehicle she was traveling in. TV footage accompanying the statement shows investigators collecting debris and fragments from the spot where the explosion happened. Investigators who described Daria Dugina as a journalist and political expert said that they had opened a murder case and would be carrying out forensic examinations to try to determine exactly what had happened. Her father is a veteran Russian philosopher known for his staunch anti-Western views. Alexander Dugin has been described in the West as one of the Kremlin's ideological masterminds, but is considered to be a marginal figure in Russia. Britain's largest opposition Labour Party has seen its membership numbers slump over the past year, raising questions about the party's current leadership. Now, since taking over from former pro-Palestine leader Jeremy Corbyn, Sir Keir Starmer has been condemned by members as leading the party into a purge of pro-Corbyn elements, including minority members. Robert Carter has a report.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
Now moving on to Turkey, where two tragic road crashes have shaken the nation to the core. At least 34 people are confirmed dead and dozens more injured. Both accidents happened in places where collisions had taken place shortly before. The casualties include first responders and journalists who are trying to help the victims. The first crash involving a bus and an ambulance killed 15 people and injured 30 more on a motorway in Gaziantep province in southeast Turkey. The second accident also happened as emergency workers were attending to an earlier incident in the southeastern Mardin province. A truck driver lost control, crashing into pedestrians. 19 people lost their lives and nearly 30 others were injured. Some of them are in critical condition. Now, after decades of violence, hopes are rising for peace in Colombia. The new president there saying that he's suspending arrest warrants and extradition requests for members of the rebel National Liberation Army, the ELN. Gustavo Petro says the move is aimed at restarting peace talks to end nearly 60 years of war. Petro says has authorized the reinstatement of protocols to allow the renegotiations to resume with the left-wing guerrilla group. Petro took office on August 7th on pledges to bring total peace to the Andean country. Talks with the ELN kicked off under the former government of Juan Manuel Santos, but were halted in 2019. The group says soon after Petro's election that it was willing to consider negotiations. Days ago, it freed six members of the security forces in a goodwill gesture. Brazil is set to hold a presidential election in less than 2 months, and thousands have attended the campaign rally for former president and leftist candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in Sao Paulo. Da Silva remains the frontrunner to win the high-stake vote set for the 2nd of October. The Worker Party's candidate is leading all polls against the right-wing incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. On Tuesday, the two top polling candidates kicked off the rival campaigns for what is believed to be the country's most polarized presidential race in decades. A runoff will follow if none of the candidates garners over 50% of the ballots in the first round, poll suggesting that in case of a potential second-round runoff, Lula da Silva will return to office. But there are fears of political violence because Bolsonaro has hinted that he would not cede power if defeated. A delegation from Iran headed by the country's Minister of Roads and Urban Development has visited Pakistan. Now, the two countries have agreed to finalize a free trade agreement within the next 6 months. Our correspondent Nasser Kazemi has more. From Islamabad.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs. The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade, and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first to six. My dad, who taught me the art of learning.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and warm greetings to you all, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, August 21st, 2022. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So, contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English Radio broadcast. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. So please don't go away and keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, your program. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card or an eQSL card from us. And here, I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Reginaldo Naldi from Brazil, and Juan Antonio Bertolin from Spain. And we've received, as usual, many emails and letters from around the world, which I mention some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails. So for this edition of Listeners Special, we will read an email from Juanrique Avila Fernandez from Costa Rica, Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, one of our old and regular listeners, David Mobby from Finland, Thomas Kutas from Poland, and the last but not the least, an email from Hector Friahofre from Chile, who is one of our old and regular listeners. After a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. As I said, Juan Rico Villa Fernandez has sent us an email from Costa Rica, so let's see what he says. Dear friends of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I send you a cordial and warm greeting. My name is Juan Rico Avila Fernandez, and I am from Costa Rica. I would like to start this email by sending you the following. My father is very fond of Iranian culture. He spends his free time drawing portraits by hand. He has several friends in the Islamic Republic of Iran. For my part, I know a lot about the Persian culture. I listen to the broadcast in the English language when the weather conditions allow me. Especially, I like the program The Call of Islam because I find a lot of wisdom in it. I love the Persian culture, art, and literature of Iran. You're really people with a wonderful and charming culture. May God continue to bless you. I say goodbye, wishing all those who work in the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting good health and peace. I await a prompt response and a QSL. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for sending us this email, Juan Rick Avila Fernandez from Costa Rica. I think it's the first time that we've received an email from you, so I suppose you have to be a new listener. I really enjoyed your message. It's great. It's great that you and your father are interested in the Iranian culture. So I have a suggestion. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio all the time and enjoy a variety of programs about the Iranian culture. Juan Rick Avila Fernandez from Costa Rica, wish you all the best. Write to us soon. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a verification. Thank you again. And from India, we've received an email from Siddhartha Bhattacharji, one of our old and regular listeners. Let's see what Siddhartha says. Here, I submit audio file of your broadcast. Hope it will be a great help for you and your technicians. Kindly send me your program schedule, sticker, stamps, and other promotional material, which is available in order to represent your radio here in India. Salam and warm greetings to you, Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, one of our old and regular listeners. Thank you very much for sending us this email. Yes, we've received the audio file you sent. Thank you for that. And as for your request about sending you the promotional items of IRIB English Radio, unfortunately, we can't, because sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio at the time of pandemic is not possible, but we have an option. Sending our great listeners an electronic QSL card. Thank you again, Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India. Wish you luck. Write to us soon. And after a short break, I will be back with other emails from our listeners from around the world. Welcome back. David Mobby from Finland has sent us an email. Let's see what David says. Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I have been a regular listener to your broadcast on shortwave for about 3 months now and saw it was high time I sent you a reception report plus a few comments about your programs. Listening to you has opened the door into another culture, and this has naturally been an enlightening experience. In particular, I have listened to your news broadcast with attention plus various features such as In the Limelight. By the way, I am 71-year-old who recently returned to listening on shortwave. Originally, I was a DX listener in my youth. My home is located on the southwest coast of Finland. I hope my reception report is of use to you. Please, could you verify my report with your EQSL? In the meantime, best wishes and hope to hear from you soon. Salam and warmest greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and from your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. Please accept our warm appreciations and gratitudes to you for sending us this kind message. David Mabi from Finland. So, it's for 3 months that you've been listening to IRIB English Radio. I suppose you have to be a new listener. It's a pleasure to have you with us. So you like the new section as well as our analytic program In the Limelight. They're my favorite too, David Mabi. Thank you. Wish you luck. Write to us soon. And your reception report is very, very helpful to us. Yes, send reception reports because by these reception reports, we will know about the quality of our programs. Thank you, David Mabi from Finland. We are looking forward to hearing from you. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. And from Poland, we've received an email from Thomas Kotas. Let's see what Thomas says. Dear staff, I am contacting you with a reception report of your broadcast. Thank you for taking the time to read my report. I hope you found it useful. If this reception report is accurate and you have the time, please verify it with an EQSL or email confirmation. Thank you. Salam and warm greetings to you, Thomas Kotas from Poland. And thank you for this message, Thomas. It's really kind of you. Wish you all the best. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon and knowing your views about our broadcast. Thomas Kotas from Poland, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Hector Friahofer from Chile. Yes, this is Listeners Special, and one of our old and regular listeners, Hector Friahofer from Chile, has sent us a message. Let's see what Hector says. Dear friends of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting IRIB English Radio, I send my greetings and also a report in audio enclosed to my email confirming that I have been a listener of your radio. I would like to receive information about your country and I certainly want to obtain a QSL card or an EQSL if it would be possible. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hector Friahofer from Chile, and please accept our warm gratitudes to you for sending us this message. Yes, we've received your audio files. Thank you for that. And my colleague will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a confirmation. Thank you for this email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about the broadcast of IRIB English Radio. So, time tells me that we have to wrap up this edition of listeners special. Many thanks for being with us. But before I say goodbye to you, I send my appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us emails, letters, and reception reports from around the world, including Hector Friehofer from Chile, Juan Antonio Bertolin from Spain, Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Reginaldo Naldi from Brazil, Juan Rick Avila Fernandez from Costa Rica, Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, David Moby from Finland, and Thomas Kotas from Poland. Thank you for being with us, and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia's special military operation against Ukraine continues. This is while the U.S. military support also continues unabated, with the latest support equaling almost another $1 billion. Meanwhile, sanctions and condemnations against Russia have never stopped. For example, the U.K. has stated that Russia has no moral right to sit at the Group of 20 Nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at where things stand, especially when it comes to the battered European economies, many facing energy shortfalls, or majority of them, coming before the upcoming winter season ahead. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. From the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders joins us from New York. Also joining us is contributor at the Schiller Institute, Karel Veris-Ken, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Sarah Flanders, let me first start with you. Trying to keep up with the pace, let alone the numbers, in terms of the dollar amount from the U.S. in the form of military support for Ukraine. Another one, $775 million, $9 billion since the conflict began, and is part of a huge $40 or $50 billion military package. What do you make of this massive military support that the U.S. is sending, which is said to be the largest arms transfer in U.S. history by some accounts?
Is this to me?
Yes, Sarah Flanders.
Well, it is an enormous subsidy to U.S. arms manufacturers. That's what it is, first and foremost. It's not meant in any defense of the people of Ukraine, who are being used as pawns in a proxy war. And it is devastating for them. It's also devastating right back here. But it is a U.S. instigated effort to recap their hegemony in the world, which is rapidly fading. And so they are willing to pump billions and billions of dollars, which are payments, as I say, to the military industries here at great profit, and ship some of it. A lot of it just gets lost, resold, repackaged, but some of it gets shipped to the Ukraine. And at the same time, it is creating enormous economic hardship in Europe, because the sanctions, which go right along with the weapons packages, are devastating throughout the world. And it's meant to create hardship, but that is what the U.S. is willing to do in an effort to recapture its position.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Carell, if we can, about what the U.S. has sent in this latest batch. And I'm particularly zooming in on these launchers by the name of HIMARS, which are not the typical, launch vehicles that were used prior. But now, recently, the U.S. has actually sent it as part of their military package, 16 to be the latest batch. Because the U.S. has actually limited that number, fearing that it's going to maybe lead to the U.S. endangering its own national security. It's pretty astounding that the U.S. is going to such limits to provide Ukraine with military assistance, isn't it, when it's looking at equipment that may actually endanger U.S.'s own national security?
Well, it does, because many wars, world wars, can also start very easily by errors of evaluation. And of course, the French Caesar cannons are already a problem, although their reach is a little bit shorter. The HIMARS, and also the, especially because they imply a lot of intelligence and assistance with radar equipment. And there, in reality, according to certain sources, there have been already strikes of by these weapon system on Russian territory itself, and then also in Crimea, which Ukraine will still pretend it is part of Ukraine, while in reality Crimea has decided to join the Russian Federation. So It is an escalation towards making Russia and also Europe co-belligerent actors in the war. And it is only the cold blood, the calculation of the Russian military, which so far has kept things on a low level. Also, the HIMARS was used to eliminate the about 100, or at least half of the 100 arrested military forces of the Azov Brigade, which were in a special prison, and which, of course, were not eliminated by the Russians themselves, because they were set to speak before the tribunal and to tell what really happened. And they most probably, most likely, were eliminated with a strike from a missile to prevent them from speaking up.
All right, there's something that's really I'm not too sure what to make of it. I'm going to call it, in a sense, shocking, Sarah Flounders, that came from the Pentagon. And I'd like to find out if you can make this out. The Pentagon has come out within the same setting, saying that right now, there, according to the statement, a complete and total lack of progress has been made by the Russians on the battlefield. But then the same organization and the person from the Pentagon has said, when pressed by the reporters, that the Ukrainians lacked sufficient troops and combat power to drive the Russians from their defensive positions. This is a complete contradiction and contrast to the stance that the Pentagon has claimed within one setting. What do you make of it?
Well, I think I would make the same thing were the statements any different on Afghanistan right until the day before the U.S. was driven out. They were winning. They claimed it again and again in every public relations statement, and they demanded that Afghan officials also say the situation is being reversed. Didn't mean that it was. And so we've always seen this declaration of victory being just around the corner, when in fact, that's not what's happening. And as long as they can sell the weapons, pump the weapons in, as far as they are concerned, they're winning. They must find wars in order to make the super profits that the military industries are really built on. And they must justify the wars. So that really becomes a self-perpetuating claim. And it is very difficult to know what's actually happening from anything in the U.S. media, because they intentionally don't explain the reason for the war and what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, they claim to care a great deal about the people of the Ukraine. They really are into totally using the people of the Ukraine and organizing and funding for years fascist or Nazi forces in the Ukraine.
Carell, if I can ask you about this, it's almost the same question, but when we look at the numbers and the different analysis on Ukraine's military might, there seems to be consensus on the fact that there's not enough manpower to defend Ukraine or to even be offensive against Russia, but that Ukraine needs equipment. The president has said that. So this kind of puts the focus on the equipment side of things. But we're talking about nuclear-powered Russia. The president has said, Vladimir Putin, nuclear weapons will not be used. But if pressed, and especially if they're looking after Crimea in what's supposed to be this big counteroffensive, do you think there's a possibility that that risks Russia using nuclear weapons of some kind?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to really predict that this will happen or not. It is, in reality, what Sarah Flanders is saying is true. We're all being lied already on the initial strategy of Russia. Russia never intended to, and that's why they say it's a military operation, because in reality they don't want to invade the entirety of Ukraine and occupy it for forever. You know, that's not absolutely not their aim. Secondly, according to the best estimates from the French military and U.S. military, it's there are three times more Ukrainian soldiers than Russian soldiers. So it's a pure lie to say that in terms of numbers, Ukrainians have much more people, which they are very badly trained and low qualified, but they have more people. That's true. And Russia is just taking time to let things work out and is expecting that at one point or another it will be very simply things will run out, and there is an inside division in the U.S., as we have seen with the declaration of Henry Kissinger, which is not my favorite at all, but who is somehow a realist, of including a realist for U.S. strategic interests, where he said, you know, that Biden administration is bringing the U.S. in a war with Russia and China into things which the U.S. has partly played on, but nobody knows how this is going to end. So even people like Kissinger, which are not real humanists, you know, are afraid that this whole thing could go out of control, and that at one point or another, yesterday there was a call by former U.S. military, the most lunatic elements, which were calling for increased weaponry and increasing, it's not only the quantity, but increasingly more offensive weapons. And that will at one point be used directly against Belarus and Russia. And at that point, then, of course, indeed, Russia could use a nuclear strike as an answer. So this is, we're sleepwalking into a big conflict if there is no wake-up call to get this thing under control.
Our guest talks about how things are getting to the point where it's out of control, Sarah Flounders. But aren't things out of control right now when you're looking at, for example, incidents that concerns Germany, where Gazprom has again announced another halt to its gas flow to Germany? Reports of Germany being deindustrialized and that they need to ration electricity. I mean, that to me sounds like things have gotten out of control just on one European country. What do you think?
Well, things are certainly out of control within the European economy. Britain also. They're feeling the impact of the sanctions that have boomeranged back on them. It's also hitting here. Not as sharply right now, but we're feeling it also. Russia, who is self-sufficient in grain, in energy, in cereals, and a lot of resources, and a great deal of industrial infrastructure, is able to survive these very harsh sanctions and is setting up new banking transactions with other countries. On the other hand, the European Union suddenly finds itself without energy that they absolutely need to fuel their industries and homes and heating and air conditioning and everything that you need in summer and winter. And every single country is feeling the shortages, with crazy messages to the populations to shower less and turn out your lights and so on. This won't solve the problems in Europe, but it really means that the sanctions are coming back and hitting them hard because they don't have an alternative to the gas and the oil that they previously exported and used in great quantity and at great advantageous to their own industries. And this is what the U.S. wants to break, because there was 10 times more trade, for example, between Germany and Russia than with the U.S. Well, they want to reverse that and close the door on trade with Russia. It is devastating for the German economy and most of the other countries in Europe that are going along with the sanctions.
Still don't understand how this can actually happen, Coral, when we take a look at the fact that there's still European countries that are purchasing gas and oil from Russia. Germany is still doing that. The Netherlands is still doing that. There are many others that are still doing that with that scheme of how they need to, exchange the euros into rubles and deposit it in one of the Russian banks, Gazprom, I believe. So, you know, that doesn't go with the way that the EU is promoting its all-out sanctions war with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, it's and it reveals the completely hypocritical system which this EU has become, because they are facing officially they want to have an embargo, but in practice they will it will take months and years, and even then, you know, we have I mean, there's a lot of oil bought from India, which is shipped somewhere else, and then it ends up even back in the United States, you know. So the whole facade of things, I mean, this is the craziness of things. They decide things which are absolutely impossible to put into practice, and because they, for example, Renault, you know, the French car industry, they sold their assets for a symbolical sum of money, sold it to the Russians, and then but they have a special deal that they can buy it back for the same price in the next 6 years, because they expect at that point, you know, maybe the war will be ended and things could be back to normal. So there is but there is a real clash between the political elites, which are completely insane, and the other on the side, the real people and the economic interests, even the which are really in shock, and also because the sanctions will not only hit Europe, but a lot of countries to which Europe, if you take for example Cambodia, you know, they buy 60%. If they have to apply the sanctions, you know, this will completely screw up supply lines for the entire Western economy. So it's and I'm not even speaking about the food riots, which can happen any day at this point.
August 18, 2022, Sarah Flanders, Diplomacy Watch. Talks to end the war are back on the agenda. This is what one of the headline reads, confirmed by some other ones. However, actions speak louder than words when you hear about the $785 million of weaponry that the U.S. sold. Doesn't sound like diplomacy is back on the agenda or on the table. But in the bigger picture, 6 months, how much diplomacy was on that scale on the left, and how much military talk of war was on the other side of the scale? Why isn't there such a push for a diplomatic solution to this conflict, do you think?
Well, frankly, the U.S. is not interested in a diplomatic solution anywhere in the world, and every treaty, every agreement they have ever made, they have violated. This is true whether it's Iran or Russia or China or the indigenous nations of the U.S. or the countries of Latin America. They do use diplomacy from time to time, but only in terms of aggressively planning the next wars. And their interest, their bottom line interest, is in using their military and economic power to maintain their world domination. That is what is slipping, because countries around the world have reached a certain industrial and technical capacity to trade and exchange with each other. That is a big change. Before this, the dollar was all powerful, and there was no way, once you were cut off from the SWIFT banking, to do some of the simplest transactions. But now, countries have found there's all forms of digital currency. In China with the SWIFT, the CIPS, in Russia with the SPSF, there's mere credit cards. There's all kinds of ways that countries are finding to arrange exchanges for the resources that they need outside of the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. as an effort to shut this down. They want each country on their own to starve. That is the purpose of sanctions, is to inflict the greatest pain on the civilian population. And countries are finding ways to survive, to exchange, to trade with each other. And it's the sanctioned countries that are actually showing the way, showing that they can survive, determination internally, and exchange with each other.
Along those lines, Carell, the news came out today that Russia will move away from the dollar, euro, and SWIFT. in its trade with partners, as it stated. And it said it's something that has been going on for quite some time. Many people don't realize Russia was actually under heavy sanctions that really initiated back in 2014 by the U.S. and then some European countries followed. How much will it take? How much longer will this take? And are we looking at the BRICS countries as an example, and then for other countries that are in the China-Russia camp to really get this trade going in their national currencies, which obviously will impact the U.S. dollar and its status one form or another?
Well, Lino LaRouche, with which I worked over a long period, was very much interested in this process, especially since 1971, when the U.S. Suspended the convertibility of the dollar to gold. And then there was first in Europe with the European snake, a defensive mechanism to be sheltered and to be protected against a dollar, which became a dollar of the international speculative caste, which is not anymore a dollar of the U.S. as such. It's run by an international banksters and not anymore one country as such. But now it was very interesting that including Iran has been proposing to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to find new ways to build a basket of physical goods, which could be the basis for a new monetary system. So there's first an increase, a move out of the IMF system,
okay,
or you can call it move out of the dollar.
Okay.
Increase of mutual trade between Russia, India, Iran, especially through the north-south transport corridor, which is very important. A new trade route opening up. And then in the next phase, this could actually become some kind of new monetary system or a new Bretton Woods, not any longer based on the dollar, but based on an
sure
agreement among countries for mutual development.
I'd like to give you just 30 seconds, please, Sarah Flounders. What has the U.S. gained from this when Russia just came out and said it will be selling its arms that it finds significantly superior to Western arms to its allies? Doesn't that endanger U.S. national security in some sense by this move? 30 seconds, please.
Well, all of this endangers the security of the entire globe. It's very short-sighted, immediate decisions for what's the most immediately profitable, and we pay the long-term costs.
Very well.
So stay up and finding new ways to resist.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. Sarah Flounders, International Action Center, Karel Barik, again, I'm a contributor of the Schiller Institute. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakhvi, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio is a guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Hujjat al-Islam Academy. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Karimi, and welcome to your program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So in a series of the programs on Islamic beliefs, especially related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the story of Karbala on the day of Ashura, today we want to talk about the first ayah of Surah Maryam as we can say we have here and there in some of the interpretations, that ayah, the first ayah of Surah Maryam, which is Hunuf al-Muqatta'a, Kaf Ha Ya Ain Sad, refers to the story of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Do you prove this point or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, there are some of the verses, in some of the chapters in the Noble Book of Quran which begin with Huruf al-Muqatta'a, or the broken letters. And according to many scholars, these are the verses which we call the ayat mutashabahat, the ambiguous verses which need explanation or, I mean, a deep interpretation. Now,